Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. What a gorgeous weekend we had. Saturday, a couple hundred water protectors were out near Pilot Mound, some with the intent of being arrested, to protest the activity of the pipeline company as it drilled under the Des Moines River. KHOI was there. And more news from North Dakota as Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman faces an arrest warrant for documenting the abuses of hired security forces there. Meanwhile, lots of Central Iowans already have their sights set on next weekend when the 6th annual Maximum Ames Music Fest offers 4 days of musical artistry from across the country and our own backyard. It's a chance for local musicians to share the stage with legends in their field. We'll have the story of a local new hip-hop duo who are doing just that. But first, tomorrow, September 13th, marks the 40th anniversary of CyRide, the service so vital to so many in our community. To commemorate this birthday, we've invited two guests into our studio, Bob Bourne, director of CyRide for 25 years, from 1981 to 2006. Bob has also been doing some research on the history of CyRide, and so we'll tap into that. And we have Karen Jameson, the first employee of CyRide, and you are still at it.
I'm still at it for a little bit longer. I retire at the end of this month.
So we're going to talk a little bit about the history of CyRide and some of the high points in that. Bob, I was surprised to find out that the start of CyRide back in 1976 came not from the university, which is what we kind of associate CyRide with right now, but from the city of Ames. How did all that come about?
Well, there was a private bus company, Midwest Transportation, that ran regular city buses, big buses on regular routes. And about 1970, they started losing money. It was paid through passenger fees, paid the whole cost up to about 1970. And then the city started subsidizing it in the early 70s, and the subsidy just kept going up and up, and which was typical of the time because expenses were going up. Finally, the city had a study done to figure out the best way to solve transportation problems. And they hired a consultant from Davenport named Bob Cherry, who owned a taxi company there. And he recommended that there be a shared ride taxi. At that time, taxis were only single rides. You got in the car and you were the only person in the car. So he recommended a shared ride system, which is what he was using in Davenport. And he predicted that it would break even, that the cost of the passenger fares would cover the cost of operation. Ames Taxi bought into that. The city wanted to do that. And all he asked from the city was for money to buy the buses, the minibuses. He figured that would be enough to capitalize it. The first name, CyRide, came in October 20th, 1975, when they were designing the system. Originally, they were going to call it Ames Taxi and then Cy's Ride and all that. And finally, it became CyRide. And then when that started, Lowell Deaton was the owner of the taxi company, and he thought he'd make money on it, and everyone thought that the transportation problem would be solved. The city council was happy because it would reduce the subsidy that they were paying, and they would just pay the one-time bus purchase cost. And that worked for a couple of months, and then the taxi company went bankrupt, and the city was subsidized.
Just a couple of months.
Yeah, it ran 5 months. And most people knew that. I think the Iowa DOT at that point was just creating its transit division. They predicted it wouldn't work because they knew the demand was too great for the amount of vehicles that would be out there.
Okay, so too many people wanting rides. And so what did they do? Did they call in and say, I want a ride?
The initial taxi went out of business in 76, in the spring of 76. That was, and that was pure dial-a-ride. That was call-in. Mm-hmm. Then Karen was hired in the summer of 76 when the city decided to take it over. So the city owned the buses because they had bought the buses that the taxi company was operating, and that's when they started four buses on the routes and for those two-hour periods in the morning and afternoon, and then there was one or two buses that were just doing random calls, like out to East Ames or someplace that the routes didn't go, and then in the middle of the day, it was just...
Dial it right, all door to door.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Passengers would give us a call, tell us where they needed to go, where they were at, what time maybe they needed to get somewhere. And we would put together what we called a flow, but it was just a schedule of pickups for the drivers. And we had minibuses, so obviously you could pick up more than one person at a time. And you would pick up and drop off along your route that you were given. And that was all dispatched.
And you were the dispatcher?
Yes.
So that means you were accepting the calls and you were communicating to the drivers?
Correct. Correct.
So did you have to sort of make up these routes on the fly?
You did, and it worked out pretty well. Ames was set up basically for it to work pretty easily. So we tried to put addresses together that were going in the same general direction and anticipate how long it would take so that the person who might need to get to work by a particular time could get there on time.
And 1976, that was the year Jimmy Carter got elected, and I think, I just remember all of the, the talk about gas and trying to reduce our use of fossil fuels and turn our thermostats down that.
Yeah, the first fuel crisis was 1973.
And
so there was a lot of talk about what mass transit should do. I was working in the Chicago area at the time, and, the future looked bright for mass transit to reduce the reliance on fossil fuels. And
okay, so what was the difference? How did SciRide manage to keep going this time when it was under city management?
Well, first of all, when I started, the director and I at the time were sent to Michigan by the city to tour a couple of services up there that were running this sort of system. And that helped a lot to understand what we needed to do. So we brought back a lot of ideas to get things started and make it work. But probably the routes going 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon, making it a little bit more predictable, certainly helped that. But we really worked hard every day just to make sure that we could handle what was coming in. And, of course, we kept getting busier and busier. And eventually you've got to add more buses and when things get busy enough that door-to-door doesn't work, you've really got to get into the route system, which we eventually did.
So you were still receiving some calls, and then at some point you said no more of that.
We got to the point we added a third route and then eventually had those running all day. Then there was door-to-door service for the disabled and the elderly. Still, we had one or two buses doing that. But running routes all day, obviously more predictable. People knew when to go out and catch the bus, and so the ridership just grows.
September 4th, 1979.
The last phone call that you received.
Yeah.
Not really, because the one thing that was amazing is how many people called up, when is the bus coming? Plus, you had so many new people every year that what bus do I take?
Right. Right.
The phone calls were constant.
Yeah, we still had people calling in asking where to catch a bus. And, of course, we started out with no real bus stops. Anybody could flag the bus down at any corner. So people called and you just told them what time the bus would be by. So we were still busy on the phone, certainly, and with everybody getting used to where the routes were going and, of course, adding that third route, which is our blue route today, we had a lot of people still needing information.
Okay. I'm talking with Bob Bourne, of director of SciRide for 25 years from the early 80s to 2006, and with Karen Jameson, who was the first employee of SciRide when it got started in 1976 and is still going with SciRide, and it is going to be SciRide's 40th birthday tomorrow.
Correct.
So, well, Karen, I want to ask, you're still with this service, and I want to know what you love about it so much. Obviously, you love it, or else you wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, it's been 40 years for me, obviously, and, SciRide has grown and changed constantly throughout those years, and that's what's exciting. We've always had new people. We hire a lot of students, so we do lose our students to graduation. And so we get new people working for us all the time, and that's new people to meet and work with. And when you grow like we have, you're always adding routes. You're always getting new buses. So it's always exciting. There's always something new, and it's been pretty easy to stay this long because it's always a challenge, and there's always something new to be excited about.
Okay, so you're a people person.
Yes.
You like the challenge the intellectual working out of things as well.
Yes.
Great. So tell me how the university got pulled into the picture.
Well, the service was inadequate from the beginning. It was under-designed for the demand. There were several study committees, either four or five, I'm not quite sure. I actually found a thesis written by somebody, and the title page and a couple pages were gone, so I'd love to know who wrote this thesis. I assume it was male. It was a civil engineering student, and he did an analysis of CSIRIDE, but he also talked about the four study groups, and then I think there's a fifth one also. So there were different study groups that were created to how to solve the transportation problem. Everyone knew that the service provided was inadequate for the demand. I mean, they were running 17 passenger vehicles. You know, now CSIRIDE has 100 vehicles, right? You know,
right, yeah.
And they were the little tiny mini buses like Herta runs. So there were several committees that were done. University was involved in a couple of them, different levels of university participation, people from the physical plant, student life. The university started a shuttle bus out to Vet Med when Vet Med opened in 77, I think, or 76. And it was just one bus running back and forth from campus to get out there. So they were incurring some transportation costs. Through some of these study committees, Ann Campbell, League of Women Voters, had she was the president at that time. That was their emphasis area, was transportation, and you'd have to ask her. I think it was 78 or 79. And they came up with the fact that, or the conclusion that they should have a transit authority. And there's a whole different legal things with a transit authority, a regional transit authority, like Des Moines or Waterloo have. But then as they talked it through, they found that a transit agency would make more sense. And that's the way Mary Greeley is. It's an agency of the city that has an independent governing board, but can be overridden by the city, and the ownership of all the assets are the city. So it was a negotiation between the students, the university, and the city, because the students were key players in the,
right.
in the whole planning of it. And they all had different viewpoints. The students wanted service now, and that was my experience with students is when they had an idea, they wanted it taken care of next week. You can't always do that.
Impetuous youth.
Right. And that creates just a whole lot of energy, which is real positive.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
University wants quality services. Things look, they've got a gorgeous campus, high quality programs. That's their emphasis, is to do things well, do them correctly. And then the city wants cost control. They want to do what's needed at the lowest possible cost. So you had three, not even competing, just three different perspectives on it. And Ann and the League of Women Voters group was able to bring those ideas together and come up with the transit agency governing structure. And then it came time for the money to show up, and the students voted a referendum to increase their student fee $7 per semester. And I think it's my understanding that at that time the students voted on the fee level every year or every 2 years. Now it just kind of gets set. I'm not quite sure how that works now. But anyway, they passed the referendum for expanded bus service. The university decided to give CSIRIDE their one bus running back and forth to Vet Med, which is the orange route now, which is the busiest route in the entire state of Iowa.
Yep, that's right.
It's busier than many entire bus systems in Iowa.
Well, there's now a lot of residences down there, too.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of things that are different. And then the city wanted in because they wanted to share the cost. So the agency was created in 1980, and then they hired me in 81, and And the mandate was to get more people on the bus. We did it.
We did it.
Yeah.
We certainly did.
And your background is, you were from Chicago working in their transit authority?
Right. Yeah. I was a bus driver in college, which is why I can relate to student drivers. Mm-hmm. And I worked out in the suburbs in Glenview and Wilmette, and I worked for the CTA for several years and then the RTA, and then finally came out here.
And presumably you had risen above a mere bus driver by the time you were hired on as the director of...
Yeah, I was the director of suburban bus operations for the Chicago area, the region.
Okay, so what was that like coming from Chicago to little old Ames?
My early experience was with Glenview Bus Company, which was a private for-profit that went bankrupt while I was driving for them. I still have a bounced check from them that I don't think I'll ever get that one paid. And then I was the manager in Wilmette, which is a suburb north of Chicago, and we had a six-bus system. And I went out and bought six buses, and we ran them around town. And it was really fun.
That was comparable,
yeah,
maybe.
Very comparable. And then I went to, I was in school for 9 years, so it was a slow, tedious educational process, you know. but I had a lot of jobs driving buses, and I was a mechanic for a while, things like that. And so what I found interesting after I graduated and went to work for the CTA, the CTA was a great place to learn. Everybody wanted you to be successful. It was really nice, but it was huge and very impersonal, and a lot of problems that existed were never solved. And then I worked at North Suburban Mass Transit District in Des Plaines, which was 88 buses, and we got up to 130 by the time I left in 2 years, and then went to the RTA. And the bigger you got, the more distance there was from the actual service, the bigger the organization. You spent time talking to supervisors and that, and not actual the service
customers
delivery. Yeah, right. And I rode I didn't own a car, so I rode to work and all the time, rode my bicycle or rode the L or the bus, depending where I was working. And so it was different, you know. And I liked the smaller system because it was real hands-on, and SciRide certainly was. And I came out and interviewed. I went and I talked to Karen after the interview went down to the bus office,
yep,
in the airport to see what kind of organization it was, and it was just delightful. So,
So, well, I want to ask Karen, now that SciRide has grown so mm-hmm. much, do mm-hmm. you see that at all? What Bob was talking about, how as you get bigger and bigger, there's less communication, or have you? It sounds like you've managed to keep that personal touch, the human touch.
Well, we do, and I'll tell you what. One of the unique things about SciRide, and we've done this since the beginning, is that everybody at SciRide can drive, except for our clerical staff. So we all have our CDL, and we all go out and drive a bus when necessary. And so you really stay in touch. And for me, right now, as the supervisor of all the drivers, it's good to know what they're doing out there. It's good to know what they go through. And so the communication there is good, I think. We really get to get out and experience it, and sometimes we're busy enough, they just need help. They need another bus on the road.
Really? So you'll just add another bus, even though it's not in the schedule to have a bus there, you'll just stick one in?
Right. We put what we call extras out, and sometimes even that's not enough. Or, you know, if there's a bus that breaks down, one of us from the office has to go take another bus out and help out. But, yes, when we get more passengers than the buses on the road can handle, any of us can grab a bus and go help out. So
they do a lot of check rides, too.
Yes.
And that's where you get to talk to. You're checking the driver, but you're also talking to the passengers.
It's one of
that's
the things I do
yeah.
fairly regularly is get out and ride with each driver. So.
Wow. That's an interesting job, talking to bus riders.
It's a lot of fun.
Quite a diverse crowd.
It is, very much so. We've got, obviously, the greatest share of our riders are the students at this point. The campus is very, very busy, and of course, they've grown over the years. But we have a lot of just Ames citizens using the bus for work, for shopping trips, and lots of kids going to school.
Hmm. Okay. So, Bob, then you were at SciRide for 25 years. That must have changed enormously in that time, and that's certainly a time when computers were more and more coming into use.
The technology changed, but the services changed too. It was interesting. It came in January of 1981, and they had leased school buses.
Right.
So they were running school buses on the regular routes because the biggest bus they owned was 21 passengers. And they were getting overloaded, and they were leaving people behind. So they leased, six or eight school buses.
That's right.
And that was an effort to solve the problem.
We needed the capacity.
Yeah, they had the capacity. They couldn't stay on schedule, but they had the capacity. And that was part of the problem, was just the cycle time to go from the mall to the end of the route back to the mall was inadequate. The city had a grant for three or four large buses, well, 30-foot-long buses. All the buses now are 40 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And those were coming in the summer. And and then the city of Ottumwa didn't have enough money to buy buses, although they had ordered them, so we bought their buses. We only had to pay 20% of the cost. The DOT paid 80%. And then we bought used buses from a guy up in Minnesota.
Right.
Who went bankrupt. And he kind of rehabilitated them. And they were early 60s buses, so they were all 20 years old and big, big buses. And we started running those on August of 1981. We started running full-size buses.
Right.
Yep. And now I hear they're going to have articulated buses, the bendy buses.
And we do. We've had two for a couple of years.
Oh, okay.
And we just got four more new ones.
All right.
So, yes, we've grown in bus size as well. Those are 60 feet long and
busting out.
Carry a lot of passengers.
It seems like that just is the basic narrative of SciRide is you get to – like you're just struggling to keep up your capacity with the demand.
Yep. 40 years of being behind.
So true. Wow. So true. Very busy.
So how are you going to celebrate the birthday?
Well, we have a couple of things planned. There will be an online scavenger hunt that we'll be putting out this week for the AIMS citizens, AIMS residents to participate in.
Oh, how fun.
And we'll have, it has to do with some SciRide trivia and things about our routes. And we'll have some prizes for that at the end.
So will they actually have to go out? I mean, a scavenger hunt, I tend to think of, you have to go out and do something.
They're going to be able to find in our schedule. If they just open up our paper printed schedule, they'll be able to find some of the answers to the questions. Some of it is things along the routes, and if they're regular riders, they'll probably know what they are. Some landmarks. So it'll be fun.
Okay. That sounds fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
No cake?
Well, we're going to have some cake at SciRide, certainly, for all the employees. we don't shy away from a chance to have cake. But we will be out also tomorrow in several locations, several different bus stops, handing out cookies to thank our passengers. So if you're lucky enough to be at the right bus stop, you'll get a cookie in the morning.
Nice. Okay. And, Bob, I asked Karen what she likes about working for SciRide. How about you? What did you enjoy about it?
Well, it's a lot of things. There's a lot of variety. It's supposed to be repetitive, but it wasn't always. You know, a good transit system, a good day is where nothing goes wrong. And a lot of people don't recognize that. You know, if everything is just flowing well, that's really a great day. A lot of people want to solve problems. If you've solved your problems, then you have no problems. So I enjoyed the interaction with the passengers. I did a lot of check rides. I rode with all the new drivers. And actually, it was more fun riding than being an administrator. I wasn't a very good administrator, so I enjoyed admit
you
that.
Had to be somewhat okay because you stayed on for 25 years.
It was a good group to work with. I mean, we had our characters that caused some heartburn from time to time. And I enjoyed, at that time, I enjoyed the vehicles. I mean, now everything's computerized. You can't figure anything out on the
right.
bus. But
you did some mechanic work.
Yeah. Well, I bought the buses and knew what worked and what didn't work and that. And I think I really enjoyed was the designing the services and then making them work correctly. And then seeing the results, which is a lot of riders on it. So when I left, it was about 4.8 million riders a year. When I started, it was 300,000 a year. Now they're going to do 7 million year.
Yeah. And, amazing.
Yeah, and I still think there's a lot of upside opportunity there. There's still areas in town that don't focus on the university. We're seeing a lot of trends. You know, I lived downtown here until last year, and you see a lot of young people that will walk or ride their bicycle or ride the bus. They'll choose whatever mode makes the most sense, and I think there's a real market opportunity for SciRide in that, and not just going to and from the university, but, you know, downtown, the whole South Duff commercial area. There's a lot of jobs down there. So there's just a lot of opportunity that SciRide has, and I think it will continue to grow.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Well, it certainly is a gem for our town. It's something we can be proud of. It's a great example of town gown interaction and cooperation. And congratulations to both of you on 40 years of success.
Thank you.
Okay, and that was Bob Bourne and a past director of SciRide, and Karen Jameson, still working at SciRide after 40 years, about to retire. So, you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio.
Bus stop, wet day, she's there, I say, please share my umbrella. Bus stop, bus go, she stays, love grows under my umbrella.
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Greta Anderson. This weekend, I was present at the protest of Dakota Access Pipeline near Pilot Mound, where 19 people were arrested for trespassing in an effort to slow progress on the crude oil pipeline as workers begin to bore its path below the Des Moines River. Nearly 200 people showed up with drums, dogs, children, colorful signs and shirts to pay their respects to the Des Moines River and to demonstrate their solidarity with Indian protesters who have been camping on the reservation of the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota since the beginning of April. Late on Friday, a federal court ruled that the Army Corps of Engineers had done due diligence when it wrote a nationwide permit to the company to cross all the rivers in its path, including the Missouri, the Big Sioux, the Des Moines, and the Mississippi. However, President Obama immediately stepped in to soften this blow to pipeline opponents. The president made a statement asking Dakota Access to voluntarily cease digging in the contested area in North Dakota while the administration reviewed whether or not the affected Indian tribes were consulted appropriately. Some argue that this action was just an attempt to defuse tensions. After a week of intense scrutiny, video footage of dogs being sicked on protesters as the pipeline company bulldozes a burial ground. This was captured by Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, which, of course, airs here on KHOI every weekday at 6 p.m. This weekend, North Dakota authorities issued a warrant for Amy's arrest. So I guess she can't go back to North Dakota, or if she does, she'll be arrested. Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president, also has a warrant for her for arrest for her involvement in the protests up there. Now, there are still two outstanding permits, including crossing under Lake Oahe, the reservoir created several decades ago that flooded out, actually, a lot of native settlements along the Missouri. Last weekend, Bernie Sanders introduced an amendment to a water bill in the Senate that would require the Corps to do an environmental impact study before it gave that permit. Amazing that such a study is not required anyway. Still, also still outstanding is a lawsuit by 15 Iowa landowners against the Iowa Utilities Board for allowing Dakota Access to seize their land through eminent domain. So all last week here in Iowa, pipeline opponents were keeping a close eye on the pipeline work and the weather. The agricultural mitigation plan laid out by the IUB specifies that construction in wet soil conditions will not commence or continue at times when or locations where the passage of heavy construction equipment may cause rutting to the extent that the topsoil and subsoil are mixed or underground drainage substructures may be damaged. Pipeline opponents sought to document what they saw violations of this stipulation when the trucks were out in rainy weather. Counties have assigned inspectors. For instance, Boone and Story County share an inspector on this project. So the very first thing the pipeline company did when it started construction long ago was to scrape the topsoil aside all along its diagonal path across the state. So the company has been arguing that no subsoil and topsoil are being mixed, and therefore its presence on rain-soaked soil is just perfectly appropriate. And it appears that inspectors are buying this argument. And by late last week, construction was proceeding despite the rains. Other folks are documenting license plates. As of yet, no one has reported seeing an Iowa license plate on any of the vehicles used by construction firms or private security. At the protest on Saturday, a friend of KHOI documented plates from Arkansas, Florida, Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota, Montana, Ohio, Oregon, South Dakota, Texas, and Texas. And these details are relevant, of course, because the project was sold to Iowans largely on the basis of its benefiting our state's economy and providing local workers jobs. To opponents, this is more evidence that the pipeline company is not being held accountable to its promises. The scene on Saturday was pleasant. As I said, nearly 200 people showed up from all around central Iowa, including large contingents from Des Moines. They sang and beat on drums and chanted chants. There was the smell of burning sage. Every so often, a truck would try to pull in or out of the gate where protesters were gathered. This is when those who sought arrest blocked entry and were arrested. Members of the Boone County Sheriff's Department were courteous as they escorted these folks to a school bus that was waiting for them. Those arrested continued to participate in the protest, hanging out of the bus windows and singing the chants. I spoke with one person who was choosing to be arrested. He seemed a kind of shy guy, but really determined in the steps he was taking. Here is Alex McCunis, public school teacher from Des Moines.
Just last night, actually. Yeah, my father received like a private message on Facebook from one of the organizers and really sincerely encouraged him to participate today. And my dad told me, Alex, if you do this, I will do it too. And I had to really think about it, you know? There are other things that I could have done today, but I made the choice to do this instead of those things. And I have never gone to jail before, and I am a public school teacher, and I have made the choice to, you know, potentially jeopardize, you know, my work teaching so that I can be involved in this and send that message that this is where the people need to be today. The pipeline is here, and we need to stand up, and we need to tell people it needs to be stopped and removed. It is not safe.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That was Alex McCunis, a public school teacher. I imagine he'll have a good story to tell his classes today about going to jail at the Boone County Jail. It was so nice to have the sound of drums at the protest. It certainly adds a heartbeat to the events. And in the studio today, we have a drummer well known for his performances with Mumford and with Dr. Murdoch, Jose Mendez. And Jose has a new band that he's been working with. It's just a hip hop duo. Welcome, Jose, and welcome, John Prosser.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Greta.
Yeah. So, of course, every year for 6 years now, Ames Music Festival, Maximum Ames, has brought national headline acts to Ames venues, and these acts are preceded by performances of local bands. And this year, one of the headliners on the billing is DJ Yella of NWA, an opening for that act will be the World Bank.
Yes.
I didn't know how to pronounce it. It has no vowels.
Yeah, you guessed it right.
Okay, and that's you two. It's a hip-hop act. Jose, you do the music, and John, you do the vocals.
Yes.
I understand. Okay. And so you're going to tell me about it. Why don't we start by figuring out who is DJ Yella from NWA?
Yeah,
I'm just a white girl with no...
I didn't know much about him until recently also. DJ Yella is Antoine Caribbee. He was one of the original members of NWA. Him and Dr. Dre started it all, and they got together with Ice Cube, Eazy-E, MC Ren, and then the rest of that crew, and then they came out with NWA, and they became one of the first biggest rap groups in basically the whole world, and because of them, there's explicit music that can be on the radio. They just had to radio edit. Before then, if your music had any bad words, anything you couldn't say on the radio, they just wouldn't let you play at all. So because of them, they put that parental advisory sticker on there, and they made it so you can at least distribute your music, even if your music has that type of language in it. So they gave all those people that didn't have a voice, still not on the radio, but it's still, they got rid of the they won't play it on the radio, I guess. So, and he just recently got inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So if you don't know who DJ Yella is, the best way to find out is to watch the movie Straight Outta Compton. It's such a great movie. It might as well be a documentary. That's what I've been saying.
Oh, okay. It's like a biopic, but it's almost a documentary.
It's so well done. It's like almost 3 hours long, and they nailed all the information really good. The acting's really good. They really went all out to make that movie as good as possible. And all the people that were part of that in history, as far as NWA and all the members, they said that they nailed the movie really good. It was very accurate.
Okay. So we're talking sort of like gangster rap?
Yeah, it was gangster rap. Yeah, it was. They were out of Compton. Their biggest hit probably is... Something the police, I won't say what the first letter is, but that kind of drew a lot of attention. And, so that's sort of like the theme that they had going on, but I don't think they were as hard as their music came off. They were just letting people know that this is their life, so they're talking about real stuff from the streets and not trying to sugarcoat it. And it just happened to sound like they were that, but they're just telling their story, basically.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. Now, you're telling your story in your rap songs as well. We have a clip for listeners to hear, but I'd like to hear you talk about it first. Hip hop, it's kind of described as more than just a genre. Like you said, it kind of is a window onto culture and
yes.
experience of
yes.
people. And so is that how do you relate to that whole concept of hip-hop? Do you have a philosophy of hip-hop or...
Well, I guess as far as like what me and John do, I don't even know if we would technically, in our own words, like call it hip-hop. I'm just making the music and then I send it to John and he puts what he wants to. So if it's called hip-hop, it's called hip-hop, but it's really... We're not trying to make it sound like anything. I just make whatever comes to mind. I send it to John. He puts whatever comes to mind and... I guess I'll let him talk about the lyrics.
Yeah, let's do that.
It's always been sort of we make what we like sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he throws me a sound that's something a little more light with some guitar going and some drums. I can rap over that. I can sing over that. We like to mess around a lot of different sounds, but it's Marty that we're playing this morning,
yeah,
right?
We're gonna hear
this particular song is one of my favorites of ours. It's fairly new. Started writing this one. I was on a little trip recently. I was just walking around downtown Oakland in California. The character in the chorus, this guy Marty, is actually a guy I met outside of a gas station in L.A. Real interesting guy, real friendly. Just sitting there plucking his banjo.
He's in a song forever now.
Yeah, it's just sort of a...
Okay, let's hear it.
Time feeling it all the time, feeling it on the grind, keeping me strong inside, keeping my soul in stride, living sometimes thrashing, sinning others passionate, finna I live dual states of mind. Street lights illuminate on the dashboard, luminous overnight. I'm new to this, lean back, try to snooze the music of this new city, city paradise, really the city fast and shitty, like burning cracks, a gritty past pain, switch anonymous, wolf brain autonomous, whole fame question all the what's sold with wages, all of us hope, phasing out of that brainless chasing lobotomy, saving face for Xanax and solo trash, and synonymous, holy crap, testing patience, lacing on tap, catching up on the lamb and matching expectations, attack, catching a solid fascination for what's faded and past, alibi always affidavit, but my chains unattached, I'm an animal. Hit the corner store, I need to buy a 40 and may be one of those candy bars with nuts and caramel coating. What's the name? There's a homeless guy that sits outside and slowly collects change. His name is Marty, and he plays his funky banjo all damn day. Before I get old, I should buy a banjo and I'll learn to sing those bluegrass songs or strum in broken stanzas, cause I'm done looking for answers. Yeah, I think I'll take my chances and stay tonight.
That was quite remarkable how many words you crammed into that.
And that's a slow one, too.
Oh,
that's
really?
A slow one compared to what he does, like 900 words per song.
Oh,
average.
My gosh. Yeah. 900 words per song average?
I'm going to say average.
It probably
now.
Averages more around like 750-ish.
He's being modest.
Wow, I've never even conceived of a song in those terms. How
I can't even scat
song?
That fast.
A couple of years ago, I wrote one about some zoo animals. It was like 1,100 or something.
Oh, my. Yeah. Zoo animals. Oh,
it was just a sort of for fun thing.
Well, I think that sounds like hip-hop because it's really about the street, a street life, you know.
That's true.
And, and I love the way that the everyday, that candy bar, you know.
Yeah.
It's just such a little mundane detail, but it's really
sweet.
It
paints a good image for you. The first time I heard that, I just, like, started smiling just because he basically paints that image of Marty for you. You don't know who this guy is. I don't know who he is, but you get to know him through this song. You did a good job with it.
Yeah, I think so. So before you were rapping with, this is a new venture you guys are doing. So before you were doing this, how were you developing all of this linguistic talent?
All right, so a few years ago, I was involved with a little hip-hop project here in Ames also. We were called Tyrannosaurus Flex, sort of like a hip-hop funk fusion sort of thing. It had like a live band, live bass and keyboard and drums. That's kind of where I started rapping. Before that, I was playing bass in a rock band, you know, mostly we'd play rock. I got my start playing punk rock songs and a little bit of reggae, and
It's amazing. And you know, you guys were just both nodding along to the song. It was fun to see. But, you know, when I've seen you play with Dr. Murdoch,
yeah.
Jose, you have that same kind of like very, you fit so many notes or so many beats or so many hits into the measure, you know, just like John is doing with his lyrics. And then, but it's different because you're being the structure guy, the lay down the very simple.
Yeah, I feel pretty comfortable though. It's almost like drums, but more drums to work with, and they just sound different. They're just more drums to work with is what I like to think of when I think of making electronic music. It's just all different types of rhythms that I can put together. think I feel pretty good about my music being rhythmic. At the very least, it's rhythmic. Whatever people think besides that, it's on them. But I feel that being a drummer, I got a lot of rhythm in my music, and I like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No. It's so you, but you're working with a synthesizer or?
Yeah, basically anything that can make sound, synthesizer, guitar, bass, samples. Been sampling a lot of jazz, Bill Evans.
Yeah, songs with bird noises. Bird noises. Flicking a propane tank. Yeah. All sorts of weird little bits.
1930s Asian songs, Japanese songs, whatever I can find. Last night, Scott Kovac was giving me some type of beatboxing stuff. I told him I could probably make something with that.
So, how do you perform? When everything is, you know, based on these recordings and samplings, then what is it like to perform, you know, in a live setting?
I think we turn it up pretty good for a live show because instead of me just standing behind like a turntable and just pressing play and letting John do all the work, I try to share some of the duties by being more active in my performance by playing synthesizer on a song. Or there's one song particularly that we perform it right on the spot, that if I don't play the finger drumming, the drums and the samples, and if John doesn't do the vocals, there is no song. If I drop the drums stop. If he stops rapping, there's no vocals. It's not, I can't press play and he can't press play. That song is made right there on the spot. And that's actually one of the samples for that one is the MASH theme song. So my roommate Dave gets me a lot of jazz samples, and that was one of the first ones I got. And right away I found a few little portions of it, and I showed it to John. Right, he didn't even have anything in mind. He had lyrics, but he didn't really have a set melody or anything. So right there on the spot, we made a song. He's like, give me this tempo, 1, 2. He gave me a tempo, and then I started playing a song to it with those samples. And right there, he started rapping over it. So I was like, so we got a song, I guess? Another song? So it was that quick.
Oh, my gosh. Well, what was the song about with the MASH lyrics or MASH sampling?
Well, all right. That one's it's a little abstract. It starts out sort of using language that you might hear associated with hypnosis, maybe. Like relax, breathe deep, that sort of thing, and then gets into more abstract imagery, supernatural oceans and weird things like that. Yeah,
that's awesome.
It's kind of a heady song, really. There's a few references to more psychedelic activities and things like that. Yeah.
I didn't know that. Now I know. Well, sometimes he's rapping so fast, I don't know what he's saying.
Wow, I just can't imagine what that would be like to have that ability to just lay down those words and just, it sounds like your mind is just this open playing field for all of these things to happen.
Sometimes I don't even feel like I'm doing it. There's a few songs that I go back and I look at it and I'm like, how did I even come up with that? Like, where did that come from? It's sometimes it just really, it almost feels like the words are what's actually dictating the song. It's like a sound that's there in my head and the words just kind of match up with it.
It's a good gift, and he does it well.
And then do you ever write it down, or does it all just...
Oh, I always have to write it down.
Okay, you do have to write it down.
Yeah, yeah. It's a long process of writing and rereading everything, and then writing one more line, and then rereading everything, and writing one more line.
It has
you get
to be
a little bit of a perfectionist with it sometimes, but it works well.
Now, in the song that we heard, there was no sampling in that, what you would call sampling,
nope,
was there?
That one I just made out of nowhere. I just got up one day, started making a song, and I had forgotten about it. And then one day I listened to it, and I showed it to John. He's like, yeah, send me this. I can totally make this into a fun, catchy song. I was like, okay. I forgot what this song was. I didn't even realize I had made it. It was just one that I made and moved on. And I think that's what makes us work so well, that I just make it, I don't think about it, and then I either show it to him, like, indirectly, or I specifically show it to him because I wanted to show it to him, and he'll just say, send it to me, and the next time I see him, he's like, this is what I got for it. I'm like, wow, every single time you put exactly what was supposed to be on there. He's just really good at working with the songs I have.
Wow, that sounds like so much fun.
It's so easy. I don't even have to think about it. I just make music, and he finishes the rest and makes it sound good.
My favorite's when Jose will be messing around with a new technique or something. Like he just watched a YouTube video, and there's something he's got to try, and he'll send me a song that sounds completely different, completely new. It's got something weird going on. It's, all right, yeah, this is fun. This is, you know, it's pushing into entirely new territory, always.
Okay, so when can we see you guys perform? It's Friday night, right?
Yeah, Friday, September 16th, 10 o'clock, DG's Tap House. We open up the show as World Bank, me and John, then both from Omaha, and then DJ Yella of NWA Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee will be closing out the night, making everybody dance. And the cool thing is, right before that, I get to play with Dr. Murdoch at Dino's for a Nova Lab show. So back to back, I get to like have the time of my life. I get to play drums for Dr. Murdoch, and then right afterwards, I get to play with the World Bank, opening up for a legend. So I'm on fire this week. I'm loving it. It's a great week to have Max Ames here.
Yeah, and then you close out the event on Sunday night
with Mumford's at Dino's Sunday night, and that's usually a fun rowdy show. I mean, I recommend every single show, but if you want to get rowdy, go to that Mumford show Sunday night at Dino's. It's gonna get crazy.
They always just blow me away every time I see them.
Body surfing Nate Logsdon. If you know Nate, you know how crazy you can get.
Of course, yeah. And a couple of other highlights for me, BJ Fleming and Jackie Blount always come. They're going to be at the library at 7 o'clock, reprising last year's performance. The women's showcase will be on Sunday, I think, from 12 to 2. KHOI gets into the action a little bit with Baby D on from 2 to 4, and on Sunday, and I think on Saturday we are hosting a poetry revival. So lots of stuff to go on, and we'll have on our website, khoifm.org, we'll have a link to the Maximum Ames website, so you can check out the schedule and decide what shows you want to catch. So, John, is this your only act for...
This is my only performance. I'm really excited to see Before Us when he plays the Dr. Murdoch show with Jordan Malin and all those guys.
I love Jordan Malin.
Yeah, I'm excited to see Blue Jack.
Yeah, Blue Jack, our boys.
Otherwise, yeah, I'm just going to be dancing all weekend.
Okay. Me too. Oh, you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started out the show with Bob Bourne and Karen Jamison talking about the 40th birthday of Cyride tomorrow. Bob was the director from 1981 to 2006. Karen has worked there since it started back in 1976. We heard a little bit of audio from the protest of the Dakota Access Pipeline this weekend near Pilot Mountain. Finally, Jose Mendez and John Prosser brought us hip-hop, or whatever you want to call it, in anticipation of this year's MAMP starting Thursday. They will perform Friday night at DG's as the opening act for DJ Yella of NWA, and that starts at 10 o'clock. Local Talk will be broadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to Ron Carson, our webmaster, for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Evan Taylor. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Bus Stop by the Hollies and Marty by the World Bank. By the way, you guys, do you have any recordings?
Not yet, but we'll have an album out on Nova Labs Records, hopefully by January, maybe soon, before then.
Okay, great. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.